I didn't know this at the time, but it turns out Obama had already had about a dozen species named after him. But I have to say ours is the best. Most of his other species are, the scientific term is icky, parasitic blood flukes, flatworms, yeah, and bugs. Not a beautiful orange and black slug that is graceful and elegant. They're really quite lovely. So if I were the Obamas, I would definitely invite a scientist over to hand out Halloween candy who named a species after them.
Our favorite marine biologist has discovered several new species of sea slugs. He named one of them after Barack Obama. He'll tell us what a Halloween sea slug has to do with the former president later on in the show. But first, you've probably seen the ads by now telling you that Prop 10 is bad for California housing. Prop 10 would allow cities in the state to enact stricter rent control laws. The campaign to defeat Prop 10 has raised nearly $75 million, and about half of that has come from some of California's biggest real estate companies. That's according to a story in today's LA Times by Liam Dillon, who's here now. Hi.
Hello.
Well, I want to play a clip of one of the ads that this opposition is funding. The speaker here in this ad, according to the ad, is a man named Malcolm Bennett, a California homeowner.
For many people of color, buying our own home is a dream we once thought was impossible. It represents a vital step up the economic ladder. But Prop 10 is an assault on that ladder. Prop 10 eliminates protections for homeowners, decreases the value of homes we rely on to save for our retirement. And 10 would create government price caps on single-family home rentals regardless of the expenses. No on 10.
Okay, can you comment on that? Because listening to him sounds like the measure would really hurt people who own their own homes.
Yes, this is sort of something, I mean, obviously in these ads there tends to be a ton of hyperbole, and I would certainly suggest that this is one that has some hyperbole in it, but I think the way the initiative is written, it leaves the sort of yes side open for these kinds of arguments. Again, what the initiative Prop 10 does is if it passes, it would eliminate a state law that currently restricts cities and counties from placing limits on rents. And so one of the protections the law has is it says no rent control on single-family homes in California right now. If this law goes away, if Prop 10 passes, then you could do that. And so that's what the gentleman in the ad is speaking to, that if you, cities and counties could, if Prop 10 passes, put rent control on a single family.
Right. So, but cities and counties don't have to do anything. This just gives them the opportunity to do so.
No, this is like, it would be, you know, this is it does everything and nothing, you could say about Prop 10, right?
Right.
It does everything in that it allows for anything you want to do with rent control to actually happen, but it does nothing because it doesn't actually implement any of those policies. That would have to come later with individual cities and counties.
Still, according to your reporting in your story today, it has major real estate companies running scared. I mean, you say that they're actually reassuring Wall Street that the measure won't pass.
Right. I mean, that's their job. I mean, you have many of these real estate companies, large real estate investors in California are publicly traded companies, and their job is to be responsible to their shareholders, and their shareholders don't want anything in the way that places a restriction on rents. And not only that, so that's obviously a big reason for why they want to fight this, and to such an extent they're fighting it in California. But also, it's interesting to take a look at the history of rent control initiatives in the United States. They tend to go in waves. Around World War II, you had a bunch of new rent control measures go in. They all went away. Most of them went away by the end of the 1950s. There was a big rise again in the 70s of more rent control measures, and then there was some key restrictions in the 90s that were put in both in California and other places around the country. And so these big landlords do not want to see another wave of rent control measures because that would affect their business all over the country, not just in California.
So they're afraid that if this passes, it'll embolden other states to do the same thing?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a very real fear.
Tell us about a company you write about called Essex Property Trust, located in San Mateo.
So Essex Property Trust is the second largest landlord in California, and they're also one of the 10 biggest in the entire country. And they're sort of especially at risk for Prop 10 because more than 80% of their apartments they own are in California. And so the market, Wall Street, has taken a pretty close look at Essex as this Prop 10 campaign has gone on. I talked to some analysts in this in the real estate market who have told me that Essex was underperforming its other sort of of competitors in this area by about 10% earlier this year. It is since the stock has since rebounded, as the sort of the polls have shown Prop 10 not doing quite as well. But that, I think, goes to show the extent to which Wall Street and investors are taking the campaigns very seriously.
And speaking of investors, a private equity firm in New York, the Blackstone Group, has donated nearly $8 million to the No on 10 side. Why?
Yeah, that includes money that is from Invitation Homes, which is a publicly traded company that in which Blackstone is a major shareholder. And Invitation Homes owns 12,000 single-family rentals in California. And so Blackstone in and of itself is a major owner of apartment complexes. And then you add Invitation's portfolio, and that's a really sizable number in the state.
And what is the National Multifamily Housing Council?
So they're the umbrella group for the apartment industry. So all of these sort of major landlords belong to it, and it's sort of the advocacy group that they have.
And they're calling this an existential threat to the industry, Prop 10.
Yeah. So they had a fall meeting, and there was a special session at that meeting that addressed what the apartment industry was trying to do to defeat Prop 10, and they called the initiative, as you said, an existential threat to the industry, which, again, I think gets at the point that we're not just talking about California here. We're talking about really the entire country and the fear that if Prop 10 were to pass, you would have emboldened, say, Boston or Washington, D.C., or other places where that are similarly having housing challenges might have more aggressive rent measures that go before voters as well.
Meanwhile, on the other side, you have the AIDS Healthcare Foundation contributing a lot, what, $23 million or so to this campaign,
yes.
To the Yes on
mm-hmm.
10. And mm-hmm. so, but that's not nearly as much as the other side, the No on 10.
Right. So they're the single largest donor to the campaign in and of itself, yes. But the no side, all the sort of landlords together are outraising them 3-1.
Okay. And so where is it in the polls right now?
Not good. So you take a look really at any poll, nothing has really had it over anywhere above the low 40s. One of the reputable polls out recently from the Public Policy Institute of California, which is a nonpartisan group, had the yes side at just 25%, which is an extraordinarily low number. And so, yeah, this is not a measure that it looks like right now voters are inclined to support.
Liam, thank you.
Thank you.
Liam Dillon. He covers California state politics and policy for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, Ed Hernandez says he wants to work with Gavin Newsom to bring universal health care to California. That is, if both of them are elected next Tuesday. Our conversation with Ed Hernandez, who wants to be the next lieutenant governor, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Next Tuesday's midterms are fast approaching. Two Democrats are running to take over Gavin Newsom's job as California's next lieutenant governor. Yesterday, we talked with Eleni Kounalakis. Today, we have her opponent, Ed Hernandez. He's an optometrist. He's a state senator. He represents parts of the San Gabriel Valley. He terms out of that position this year, and Ed Hernandez joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, a lot of the lieutenant governor's ability to accomplish things really depends on what the governor allows him or her to do. You said that yourself. You're quoted in an article saying, my success will depend on what he being the next governor, allows me to do. So how will you convince the governor to let you take on the issues you want to take on? And what are those issues?
Well, I mean, obviously, I want to win, and hopefully I do so on Tuesday. And the first order of business would be to congratulate Gavin Newsom upon his victory as well and reach out. I do have a relationship with him, but hopefully build even a stronger relationship and tell him that, listen, here's what I want to do. I want to be, number one, a partner with him to try to make sure that we accomplish things together for California, being both Democrats. But a number one priority would be to restore the budget that it used to be when, back in the day when Cruz Bustamante or John Garamendi had to allow me the resources to be able to have the staff to be able to do things that are important to me. That would be healthcare and obviously education, and then obviously sitting on the various boards that I would be sitting on.
Healthcare. So you have focused on that as a state senator. What in particular would you want to accomplish?
So here's what I'd like to accomplish is continue the work that I've done since I've been chair of the Senate Health Committee. There's three things that are of priority to me. Number one, the successful implementation of the Affordable Care Act, access to care of the most vulnerable, and controlling healthcare costs. If you think about what California has done in taking a leadership role with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act by decreasing our uninsured by half, having a robust marketplace, and riding out this wave or this assault by the federal government. But what I can bring to the governor is the relationships that I've built over the last 12 years with the stakeholders, to continue to do that work to achieve universal coverage, but more importantly, to control healthcare costs and get access.
Well, Gavin Newsom is for single payer, and it sounds like you're for universal health care, which is not necessarily single payer, which would involve private insurance.
Well, so obviously I'm a big advocate of the Affordable Care Act. I've carried all the bills for its implementation, but also I voted for SB 562, the single payer bill that came through my committee, and I'm open to a conversation, anything to do to get to the point where we have what I would call universal coverage. But what we fail to talk about in either, whether it's single payer or whether it's universal coverage, number one is access to care for the most vulnerable populations. And we have to have a conversation about controlling healthcare costs. Because it doesn't matter what system we have, the cost of healthcare continues to rise and we have to stop that.
And how would you do that?
Well, we can do it a variety of ways. An example is a bill that I ran numerous times. It finally got through the legislature, got passed by the governor. SB 17, which brings transparency to our pharmaceutical drug industry. It's now becoming a national model. Other things we need to do is looking at alt payers' databases, but also monopolization of markets. Since the Affordable Care Act and its implementation, there's been a lot of market consolidations, like hospital systems that are charging a lot more up in Northern California compared to Southern California. We just have to have the political will to be able to have that conversation. And yes, they're tough conversations, but we have to do it if we're going to make sure that everybody has not only affordable access to care, but affordable insurance premiums.
And what does your job look like if you win and the Republican, John Cox, becomes the next governor?
Well, I hope he doesn't. And if he does, I can guarantee my budget would probably be zeroed out or next to nothing. And so I probably wouldn't have very many resources. But obviously, you know who I'm supporting.
So you wouldn't really have a job, is what you're saying?
Oh, I would have a job. I have a constitutional obligation to be lieutenant governor. I would still sit on the UC Board of Regents, the CSU Board of Trustees, the Lands Commission, the Economic Development Commission. I might have maybe one or two staff. I would still do my job. I would still go to the Senate floor and lobby and talk to members that I've had a relationship over the last 12 years. I'd work with a pro tem. I'd sponsor bills. I'd preside over the Senate. I'd go to caucus. You know, I try to go to the assembly, talk to the speaker, colleagues that I know in the assembly as well. Yes, I would still work. I'd still govern. The only difference is I'd have many, many less resources and make it a little bit tougher because, you know, it's a big state. You know, I'd love to be able to have an office in San Diego, in the Central Valley, L.A., obviously Sacramento. And the more resources I have, the more work that I'd be able to do to reach out to constituents throughout the state of California.
Well, in the early years when Gavin Newsom was lieutenant governor, he basically admitted that he didn't have much to do except scan the newspaper to see if Governor Brown was still alive. And if so, okay, that was it. And the LA Times found that he missed scores of meetings he was supposed to be at, meetings at the, you know, the university board meetings, California State Lands Commission as well. Will you commit to going to all those meetings? And do you think Gavin Newsom made a mistake by, apparently in the first 2 years, not taking his job entirely seriously?
Well, of course I'll commit. And the only thing I would say is look at my record as a public servant in my entire 12 years in the legislature. I think I've only missed maybe 1 to 2 days, and I can count them on one hand, and I can guarantee that's because I either got a cold or got sick or something personal happened with my family. I've literally been at every committee hearing, read all the bills, listen to testimony. I take my job very serious, and I do the same thing. I would attend, you know, all the UC Board of Regents, CSU Board of Trustees, the Lands Commission, Economic Development Commission. You know, as far as Lieutenant Governor Newsom, I mean, you know, I can't speak for why he didn't go, and, you know, I'm assuming he has a reason. But, you know, I will continue to govern the way I've done the last 12 years.
Well, speaking of sitting on the university boards, what do you think is the biggest issue that the higher education system faces, and what would you do about it?
So I think the biggest issue facing our state of California is getting middle income and low-income students the ability to go through college, but more importantly, the affordability of college. We now need to start looking at costs, for example, like food, transportation, books. We need to look at housing. We need to look at, you know, babysitting for families. But the other thing that we have to do, I strongly believe, we have to look at our master plan. The last time we addressed our master plan was in the 1960s. It was a much, much different California. We had a population of 20 million people. It looked different, sounded different, and acted different. We are now pushing 40 million. It's much more diverse. I really believe that the economic success of the state of California is through our middle class, but more importantly, through higher education, whether it's community college, career tech, CSU, UC. This is how California and its economics engine is going to continue to move forward and meet the demands of the 21st century. And so to me, that's what I like to do. And I also use my personal story as an example of what I went through to get through college. You know, as a young parent working full-time, taking, you know, full-time classes, working 35 hours a week, community college, Cal State University, then eventually getting accepted to optometry school, we have to look at ways for young adults to be able to get through college.
Well, when you mean relook at the master plan, what do you mean by that specifically?
So the last time we did the master plan was in the 1960s. We're starting to look at it just briefly now. We have an assembly member that has a select committee that's looking at the master plan. I've already reached out to Assembly Member Berman. He's only had a few hearings. We need to totally look at it strategically, how we're going to bring in business, how we're going to reduce the cost of education. Does that mean we look at an income source outside of the general fund, like, say, K-12? But do something strategically. Also, been working with Steve Glazier, who has a select committee on higher education, just started a couple years ago, to continue that work with both those legislators. But we have not addressed the master plan in decades, and it's about time that we do it if we are seriously going to look at making a change in our higher educational system.
Well, how do you make college more affordable? It's really hard to roll back tuition increases once they've been put into place.
Well, yes, it is. It's hard to roll back tuitions. And if you look at what happens in our budget, you know, right now, fortunately, we have good economic times where, you know, we're actually fighting to try to restore and get, you know, more money into our CSU and our UC system, as well as into our community college system. But here's what could happen. You know, it could happen on my watch should I become lieutenant governor. We probably will have another recession. And if we do, we're going to be making tough budget decisions, especially when it comes to higher education, K-12, healthcare, I mean, you name it. That's why I said we need to look at the master plan, because we have to look at bringing in an additional revenue source outside of the general fund to make an investment in higher education. And that could mean, you know, going to the people of the state of California in some form of, whether it's an initiative to increase sales tax, whether it's property tax, but there needs to be discussion to see if the public is willing to have that.
Was it a mistake for the UC and to some extent the Cal State system to accept foreign students to pay higher tuitions because of state cutbacks?
You know, I don't know if it was a mistake, but I believe that if we have a California State University system and University of California system, I think the number one highest priority should be California residents. We should make it more affordable, obviously, and we should make sure that there's as many spaces available. But I think what happened, you know, as I mentioned, there was a recession not too long ago and, you know, cuts were made and you had to balance the budget and you had to bring in resources. And I think that was a way and that was a decision they made. And I think in the future, hopefully we won't have to make those decisions if we can figure out how we're going to get additional resources.
Okay. And are you using this position as a launching pad to be the state's next governor?
You know, I'm running to make sure that I become a very effective lieutenant governor. First of all, I never, ever imagined that I'd ever run for office. The only thing I ever did politically was I voted on a regular basis because my dad instilled those values in me. I read the newspaper and I watched TV and the news. You know, I wasn't a poli sci major, I'm an optometrist. I got angry because of our healthcare system and I wanted to make a difference. And I'll tell you, as long as the voters of this state allow me to be a public servant, I'll continue to do so. But, you know, right now I'm interested in only one office right now, and that's becoming lieutenant governor.
So you wouldn't say no. You're thinking about
I'm just interested in becoming lieutenant governor.
Okay.
At this time.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on.
Ed Hernandez, running to be the next lieutenant governor of California. We'll Coming up, photographer Lindsay Addario risks her life to take pictures in war zones.
We were told to lie face down in the dirt. We each had a Kalashnikov put to our heads. We were about to be executed.
My conversation with her about being kidnapped and why she still covers the most dangerous places on Earth, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Lindsay Addario has dedicated and risked her life to work in some of the most dangerous places in the world. The Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist helped bring the front lines of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq to the pages of the New York Times, Time Magazine, National Geographic. She's also documented gruesome civil wars and humanitarian crises in Libya, South Sudan, and Syria. Of particular focus for her are women living in these conflict zones and how violence affects their lives. Lindsay Addario has compiled some of the most striking images from her two decades in the field in a new book. It's called Of Love and War, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, this is your first photography book, but you've been doing this for a while, right? So, and you wrote a memoir before. Why did you take so long to put out this book of photos?
I did write a memoir before I put together a photo book, which is very strange because most photographers, of course, do a photo book first. But I, after being kidnapped in Libya in 2011, I was actually about to do a photo book. And then I got news that two of my friends were killed in Libya, Chris Hondros and Tim Hetherington. And I suddenly, I had a complete breakdown and I had survivor's guilt and I had a very hard time processing their deaths rather than my own kidnapping. And I decided I didn't actually want to do a photo book at that time because I didn't want to sit with these really sort of traumatic and violent images while I put together that book at that time in my life. But eventually it sort of felt right to start looking at this a few years ago. And so I met with a book designer and we started sort of hashing out how to comb through millions of photographs.
Well, I do want to talk about the Libya kidnapping in a moment, but just to get the overall thesis for how you chose those relatively few photos, what were you looking for?
So I wasn't really sure. I mean, I had spent about a year or 2 years kind of pulling together folders of images that have sat with me over time from kind of all around the world, in the Middle East, Africa. And, you know, these are sort of the images that I, for example, whenever I do public speaking or when I talk about things, I revert back to these images. And so it sort of made sense that they would condense into these sort of 200 or so pictures. But it was a hard process because there were some images that just didn't flow with the rest of the book. And so they fell out. And, you know, it's my first photo book. So I there were some that I really wanted in there.
I want to talk about one in particular. This is a photo. It's a portrait of a woman, a young woman named Bibi Aisha. She's from Afghanistan and she is missing her nose in this photograph. Can you talk about her story and how you got her to agree to having her portrait taken by you?
Sure. So most of my work in Afghanistan was on women, was on women's issues, was on civilian casualties. And of course, I did many military embeds as well. But for me, the story of women is a tragic one in Afghanistan, because what I found over the years is that physical and emotional abuse against women in Afghanistan is so prevalent that it's actually hard to meet a woman who hasn't been abused. And so in 2009, I was working on a story for National Geographic magazine about women in Afghanistan. It was a story that I had proposed, and because I felt like after a decade of working there that I had the experience to do a story like that. And I had had amazing contacts at that point across the country. And there was this woman, Manisha, who ran Women for Afghan Women in Kabul. And that was a shelter for women who had been beaten or women who had been shunned from their families and had no place to stay. And so Manisha called me and said, you know, I think you should come in here because there's a young woman that you should interview. And And I said, okay. And I went to the shelter and I sat with Bibi Aisha and we talked about her life and what happened when she was very young. She was married off to someone who was a Taliban or loyal to the Taliban. And he was extremely abusive, physically abusive. And she, in Afghanistan, a woman needs her husband's permission to leave the house. And so finally, the beatings got so bad that she fled. And he was so angry that she had left the house without his permission and that she was disobeying him and dishonoring him that he took her to the mountains and, surrounded by other Taliban fighters, literally sliced her nose off of her face. Time magazine also did a story and featured her on the cover. So you might remember her from the cover also of Time magazine.
Yeah.
But that's the story of Bibi Aisha. And she actually, I believe she's living in America right now. Many people, in reaction to the photographs of her, sponsored her to come to America for reconstructive surgery. And I believe she never left.
Mm. And in your photo of her, she's looking away from the camera. She's not looking directly at the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose that particular stance? Because it seems like she's almost afraid of looking directly at the viewer.
Sure, and I think that's exactly part of her character at that moment in her life. You know, she was really traumatized, and it was almost as if she wasn't confronting that moment in her life. But I shoot both ways. You know, I have many pictures of her looking directly at the camera. But I think, you know, in my editor's opinion and in my opinion, this sort of seemed to represent where she was at emotionally at that time.
And the following photos are of women who have tried to set themselves on fire as a way of escaping or as a way of trying to commit suicide. It seems a particularly desperate act to do that.
That story was so painful and so horrifying. I mean, that, you know, again, that's a story I did several different times in Afghanistan, and I spent time in the burn ward in Herat. I think what happens in Afghanistan is there's a lot of judgment on women. And so a woman who is in an abusive household, who is married into a household where the mother-in-law often beats her, that's very common as well. It's not only the husbands or the men, it's often the mothers-in-law. She doesn't have an escape. Culturally, if she asks for a divorce, that is such a shame upon the family that she will be ostracized and she will be kicked out. And sometimes she will be killed for shaming the family for even asking for a divorce. So it's easier to kill yourself and to try and do that with self-immolation, because that is something I learned that many of these women see or they hear about and they mimic. But it's a slow and painful death, because many of these women have over 30% of their bodies burned. Their survival, the chances of survival are very low, but they live for a few weeks. And in those few weeks, it's extremely painful.
God, that is just unbelievable.
It was so heartbreaking.
Tragic. Yeah.
It was such a heartbreaking story.
Gosh. You know, and a lot of people say, okay, yeah, we've been in the longest war in U.S. history. It's still going on, but at least there's one positive outcome, and that has been the improvement of the lives for women and girls in Afghanistan. Is that true?
I mean, not across the board, no. I mean, there are there have been great changes for some women in Afghanistan. There are women in parliament. Women are out in the workforce more than before. You know, they certainly are being educated more. But in the provinces and outside of the main cities of Kabul, Jalalabad, you know, there hasn't been a huge amount of improvement. It still is the case in many of these places, in many of these rural villages, where a young girl who's been put in school and encouraged to go to school by the American government and coalition forces in Afghanistan, through the Afghan government. Often when she gets her first period, she's pulled out of school to get married because that's the tradition.
I want to talk about your photos of a young boy named Chul from South Sudan, and he has a really remarkable story of escape and survival. He was, 9 years old when he had to flee?
So in many of these places, people don't know their age. So he was about 9. He could be anywhere from 9 to 12, we estimated. And when I met Chol, he had fled from his village in Lair, outside of Lair in South Sudan. His village had been attacked by government forces, and his father was killed. And he fled for his life with his grandmother and a sister. He was trying to make his way with his grandmother and sister to Kenya because they had relatives there and Chol wanted to go to school and they were seeking safety. But because they fled in the middle of the night when their village was attacked, he left behind his mother and about 8 siblings in this village outside of Lair. And so he didn't know if his mother was alive. He didn't know if his siblings had survived because it was so chaotic in the aftermath of that. So we spent about 5 days with him. And then, as I always do, I leave my phone number and email for them. And I left it with his grandmother, who spoke a little bit of English. And about a month later, I got a call from the grandmother. And she said, "Miss Lindsay, we're in Kenya." And essentially, we ended up touching base every sort of month or so. And they would call me and say hello and, you know, tell me how Chol was. So about 6 months later, I got an assignment from Time magazine to go to Lair. So we ended up getting in and I thought, geez, I wonder if I can find Chol's mother. And so I started asking the ICRC, which traces families that have been separated. And they said, you know, there's a food distribution tomorrow and there are 17,000 people coming. So if Chol's mother is alive, she'll be there because she'll be hungry. And so I said, yeah, what are the chances of finding a woman in 17,000 people? So I gave her name and the village name to someone at the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross. And within a few hours, someone came to me and said, "This is Chol's mother." And I said, "No, I don't believe it." And so I started asking her all these questions, like, "What happened to your son? What happened to your husband? Is your husband alive? What village are you from?" And eventually I realized it was really her. And I started crying. I just sort of broke down. And I thought, what are the chances that I'm finding Chol's mother? And so I asked if I could go to her house the next day. And I had brought a copy of the New York Times Magazine with Chol on the cover just in case I found her. And so I went to her and I brought the magazine to her and her grandmother, who was still alive, and they looked at Chol and they both just started weeping, saying, my son, he's alive, and realizing that I was the messenger between this mother and her son. And so I recorded a video of her to bring to Chol, and then I went to Kakuma and I saw him there and I brought him the video of his mother. And so they realized they're both alive and I was able to connect them.
Oh my gosh, that must have been so satisfying for you.
I mean, it was so satisfying, but so, I mean, I was so gutted after that story. I felt like I had had such an emotional upheaval. And also, my back went out, and I couldn't even stand up. And I was on such a mission to find Chol that I ended up basically taking so many muscle relaxers to be able to even see him, to bring him this video of his mother. That, like, the videos of me recording, you know, meeting with Chol, I look like, you know, because I was so determined to see him that I just wanted to connect these two.
Yeah. Well, also, how often do you get to see the story play out? Because you take so many photos, you go into war zones, spend, as you say, 5 days documenting Chol's journey, and then probably in most cases you never see the people you photograph again, right?
That's absolutely right. It's very, very hard to trace people and to go back. You know, sometimes I go and I spend these unbelievably intense times with families or with a woman or whoever it is, and I don't see them again.
So let's get to Libya. You covered the uprising in 2011, and you were kidnapped, as you mentioned, with 3 other journalists. And you write that you, although you had been to all sorts of really scary places and war zones and the like, had never seen anything as scary as Libya. Why was Libya so different?
You know, I think for many reasons. I think, first of all, the nature of the war in Libya, it was along one paved road that went from eastern Libya, from Benghazi all the way to Tripoli. And the terrain was very open and flat, so there was no place to hide. There was really literally no place for cover. And at that point, Gaddafi had, he was using airstrikes. He had helicopter gunships coming in, spraying the ground around us with, I think, 50 caliber bullets. And we were with a completely untrained militia. I mean, the guys that we were with and covering for the popular uprising were essentially a bunch of teachers and engineers and doctors who had no experience in fighting. I also think, you know, for us, we, all the journalists covering the popular uprising in eastern Libya, snuck in illegally because Gaddafi did not want journalists covering the uprising, so he wasn't giving visas to go there. So, of course, we knew that the danger as journalists was running into Gaddafi's troops or being overrun by his troops because we didn't have visas and we could be thrown in prison.
Mm. Right.
Which is what happened.
Which is what happened, exactly. So you're ambushed at a checkpoint and taken prisoner. Were you afraid that you were going to be sexually abused?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, my first and foremost concern was that I was going to be killed. I mean, we were told to lie face down in the dirt. We each had a Kalashnikov put to our heads. We were about to be executed. And at that moment, the commander said, you can't kill them. They're Americans. So they then tied us up, blindfolded us. And for me, as the only woman, the main fear I had, aside from survival, was that I would be raped. I had covered rape as a weapon of war in so many countries around the Middle East and Africa. And why wouldn't I fall victim to the same thing that so many women I had covered had fallen victim to?
So you weren't raped?
I was not raped, no.
But you were groped?
I was groped. I was, my genitals were touched over my jeans repeatedly. I'd say pretty much every man whose hands we fell into touched me and my body.
Wow. How did that change you and how you approach your job?
I mean, I'm going to say this and I know I'm going to sound crazy, but I think, you know, I'm still doing this job. You know, I just came back from Yemen. I was just in northern Nigeria. I'm still working in war zones all the time. But I'm not covering frontline as much. Now, to be honest, that's not a direct result of Libya. That's a result of I've done this job for almost 2 decades. I've lost a lot of friends. I've been kidnapped twice. I've been thrown out of a car on a highway. I kind of feel like I'm running out of chances. And so I think for me, the more interesting stories visually are always to cover what happens as a result of war.
So you've been in Yemen, and so you've seen the results of what's been going on with the Saudi-led bombing of Yemen.
Correct.
In this civil war. What are you seeing that we haven't heard?
I mean, first of all, we haven't heard almost anything because it's almost impossible for a journalist to get in. I've been trying to get into Yemen for 2 years. You know, you need permission not only from the Yemeni government, but also from the Houthis who are in control of Sana'a and the northern part of Yemen. Basically, what we are not seeing is the fact that hundreds of thousands, if not millions, are on the brink of famine. You know, you see children, the hospitals are full of children with severe malnutrition. They have complications associated with malnutrition. There are, you know, thousands of Yemenis who have been displaced from their homes within Yemen, who are living on the sidewalks, who are living in schools. They're living in sort of makeshift tent camps because very few aid agencies are in there working. They don't have the funding. You know, a lot of the role of journalists is we get the story out and, you know, funding is often generated as a result of the stories we do for UNICEF and for a lot of these UN organizations. But because no journalists have gotten in, it's sort of the forgotten war.
Yeah. Are you at all frustrated by the fact that here in the United States, the news media is just completely consumed with domestic news and politics in the Trump era? Does that crowd out what you cover, these international stories?
No, I'm not frustrated by that. I think it's very natural at this point in our country's, you know, where we're at in our country right now. People are focused on domestic issues. I actually have been working a lot more in America, ironically, in this past sort of year. But what frustrates me is the rhetoric that journalists are the enemy of the people, that the media is blamed for almost everything by the president. And I think that is a terrifying and very dangerous place to be.
Do you think that you're more in danger now?
Absolutely. There's not even a question. I mean, I think the more president says journalists are the enemy of the people, his people who believe what he says and who follows him, they feel like they have license to be violent against journalists. And I'm not talking about only within the United States. I'm talking about overseas, too. You know, there are authoritarian regimes. There are leaders of other countries who don't respect journalism and free press anyway. And now they feel like they have license to do what they want with their own local journalists because they assume that the, you know, Americans won't take them to task.
Well, Lindsay, I want to thank you so much for your work, for your words, for your book. It's really important stuff. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That's Lindsay Addario. Her new book of photos is called Of Love and War. You can catch her at the LA Central Library tomorrow night, where she'll be talking about her book. She'll be talking about her photography, telling more stories about the people that she photographed. And reservations for the event are closed, but standby spots still available at the library. So go check it out. And if you want to see photos from Lindsay Addario's book, we have a slideshow up. Just go to kcrw.com/curious. Coming up, just in time for Halloween, a new black and orange sea slug is discovered near Catalina. A conversation with my favorite marine biologist next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A new species of sea slug has been discovered by a diver off Catalina Island. Just in time for Halloween, this slug is bright orange and black. The species is usually found off the Galapagos. So scientists think it must have come north during the last El Nino and made its home in our warming waters. My favorite marine biologist is in the studio with me now, Pat Krug. He's here to talk about this and other slugs. New slug discoveries. Fantastic.
Hi, Madeline. Thank you.
Hi there. Well, let's talk about this Halloween slug.
I'm excited to. We discovered and named three new species with vivid Halloween colors. They're super beautiful orange and black slugs from the Pacific.
What did you name them?
Well, the first one we named Placida brookae in honor of Brooke Peterson, who is the diver you mentioned, a photographer and diver who first brought it to our attention out on Catalina Island.
And how did she discover this slug?
Well, it's a little hard to miss. It's
so bright.
Super colorful, and Catalina has been extremely well explored by divers who like to photograph particularly sea slugs because they're, you know, kind of colorful and eye-catching. And so you would think if there was a very vividly colored slug out there, it would have been discovered in the last 50 years. And this one was not seen until relatively recently. So Brooke was noticing it in 2014. That's when these specimens were collected, which actually slightly predates the last El Nino, but it does coincide with a period of extended warming of the North Pacific that was called the blob.
That's the scientific term.
Right, right. This is all very scientific sounding. The blob was the name given to a huge area of like a million square meter area of the North Pacific that was about 3 degrees centigrade warmer than that part of the ocean should have been. Our oceans were superheated in this part of the world for an extended period of about 4 years.
And what did the blob do?
It did a lot of things. It ate New York. it had a number of profound effects on our weather. So normally there would be low pressure systems sitting over the Pacific. And instead there was this extended period of high pressure, and that and the warm ocean directly contributed to our warm, dry winters, which in turn fed into our drought and then those really intense wildfires that we've been having. So that can all be traced back to our warming oceans.
So from the large, the wildfire, to the small, the sea slug, the blob is to blame.
It certainly was a contributor and probably a driver.
Or are we excited that this sea slug is here?
Well, I mean, I'm excited because we got to name it, it's not that often that you find a new species here in the LA area, but as far as we can make out, this species is genetically indistinguishable from populations down in the Galapagos and in Mexico, and since it was never here before, it must have extended its range north in 2014-15 because our waters were warm enough mm-hmm. now for a tropical, subtropical species to take up residence and make a home locally.
There's another one that you've discovered that eats a highly invasive killer algae. And how do you say what the name of this killer algae is?
Calerpa. Calerpa taxifolia is the full name of the killer algae.
What? Da-da-da-da. This is really a Halloween segment here. You've got the black and orange slug, the blob, the killer algae. What does killer algae do?
It took its name from a horrible invasion of the Mediterranean. So Calerpa taxifolia is normally native to the Pacific, but a little piece of it was accidentally released by, this is a little awkward, the Jacques Cousteau Aquarium in Monaco let some out, and it rapidly
went crazy.
I know. It took over the Mediterranean, and by took over, I mean there are just vast sections of the Mediterranean that are a meadow of nothing but this green algae, because it's toxic, so nothing eats it.
Except for the slug.
Except for a few sea slugs in the group that I study, which is a nice coincidence because...
So you're going to save the world.
I'm going to try. It's hard to make people care about slugs, but if they're the only things that eat super invasive algae. So this same algae... actually, it tried to invade California because a doofus in San Diego dumped his saltwater aquarium into a lagoon, and the state of California spent something like $7 million on an emergency eradication campaign, so we didn't get invaded. Australia's been invaded. Japan has been invaded. So there's a lot of interest in understanding species that do eat this stuff and what kinds of Calerpa they like.
And so this particular slug is feasting on it?
Not only do they feast on it, but they actually impersonate it. So their bodies mimic the algae. So they look just like a living, crawling piece of the algae. And what we found was that what was thought to be one species was actually five different species of slug, and each slug mimics a different kind of Calerpa. And so they have evolved to perfectly mimic and resemble their food, which is also their habitat.
So that's one sea slug. And then you discovered another one that you've named Barack Obama.
We did name another one of the Halloween colored slugs after Barack Obama, Placida Barack Obamae. We discovered that species in Hawaii, and we wanted to recognize Obama for extending a National Marine Monument in Hawaii. He expanded this monument so that it was the largest marine protected area in our national waters. And God, we miss him and his administration's stewardship of the environment. So I wouldn't say we named it after him just to troll Donald Trump, but it was like a part of it. But definitely, we wanted to recognize the past administration's commitment to protecting the environment.
Do you think he'd want to have a sea slug named after him?
Well, I didn't know this at the time, but it turns out Obama had already had about a dozen species named after him. But I have to say ours is the best. Most of his other species are... the scientific term is icky. They include parasitic blood flukes, flatworms, and bugs. Not a beautiful orange and black slug that is graceful and elegant. They're really quite lovely. So if I were the Obamas, I would definitely invite a scientist over to hand out Halloween candy who named a species after them. Just saying.
I wonder who that could be. Oh, Pat Krug. He's a marine biologist at Cal State LA. Thanks for coming in.
Anytime, Madeline.
You can check out photos of the sea slugs on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.